You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Ballad of Bitcoin, Bonnie and Clyde by Nick Bilton, with illustrations by Jonathan Bartlett. In late 2021, as investigators were running surveillance operations on Liechtenstein and Morgan, the couple boarded a plane and flew to the West Coast to get married. The ceremony took place at Playa Studios in Culver City, California, but like all things about the duo, the wedding itself was not a traditional affair. Their friends waved gold spray-painted banana leaves with sexual innuendos as Morgan, dressed in gold herself, was carried into the ceremony on a Moroccan palanquin. The 100 or so guests were given Razzlecon stickers as offerings. The couple's first dance was to the trance, clubby, eccentric song Golden Boy by Sin with Sebastian, where the newlyweds thrust their arms in the air repeatedly as they jogged in place. Then, at the reception, Morgan transformed into Razzlecon and rapped her latest song, Moon and Stars, which was about Liechtenstein. The song opens with Liechtenstein saying, "I love you, I support you, but I don't want to be involved." While Liechtenstein proudly watched from the side, other guests, especially the elderly, were seemingly in a state of confusion. This was followed by a magic performance by Liechtenstein, who wore a black suit and black shirt and performed a mentalist David Blaine-like magic trick, where he told guests to recall a fond memory of Morgan and then went around the room guessing what moment was in their head. He was actually really good, one guest told me. He got quite a few of them right. They both cried during their vows, where they talked about where they had met, San Francisco, how they had fallen in love, over shared eccentricities and a love for waffle parties, and how they'd moved to New York City to start a family together. They were clearly in love, and having both been labeled eccentrics their whole lives, they'd found each other. He called her his best friend and the woman of my dreams. After the ceremony, Morgan surreptitiously told 24 of the couple's closest friends that a secret bus would pick them up later in the evening and take them to an exclusive after-party. The bus weaved through Los Angeles and dropped them off at a mansion in Westlake Village. There, at a massive home, a DJ played and bartenders and waiters passed hors d'oeuvres. Guests were told not to share any of this on social media. "We are sitting in this massive mansion, being served this incredible food, and I kept wondering how they were able to afford all of this," one of Morgan's longtime friends told me. Back in New York City, after the wedding. While Liechtenstein was seemingly confident about his plan to launder the billions of dollars in stolen Bitcoin and eventually set off to Ukraine, where they could not be touched by the U.S. government, as there is no extradition treaty with the United States, Morgan was starting to feel the pressure. Friends from earlier in her life who hadn't seen Morgan in a while were a little shocked by how much she had changed. She was more confident with Liechtenstein, but there was also a bit of a crack in the veneer. Not of their relationship, but of her. A group of friends whom she had been in a Japanese club with had wondered if her Razzlecon alter ego was her way of dealing with something bigger, some sort of pressure she didn't know how else to release. Next illustration shows Liechtenstein being handcuffed during an arrest, with Morgan looking on and the cat perched on her shoulder, looking horrified. Life for Morgan had not been easy, She was an only child who had grown up in Tehama, California, population around 400. At Lassen View Elementary School, her classmates made fun of her high-pitched voice and lisp. By the time she got to Pleasant Valley High School in Chico, a 30-minute bus ride away, she had started using a rolling suitcase for her books, and in the hallways, kids would kick the wheels and laugh as she walked by. Her friend Kyle Peavers told me that he often just saw her standing by herself at lunch without anyone to talk to. She eventually made friends with, I can call them non-socialites, kids in science and math class that have scientific skills, but you can't sit down and have a beer with them, Peavers said. When she arrived in San Francisco after college, according to more than half a dozen people who knew her then, Morgan desperately wanted to be accepted. She would hang out at the Cuban Cigar Bar in North Beach, where the marketing and sales tech folks congregated to network. Clearly uncomfortable, she started to drink to feel more at ease, something industry colleagues started to notice. She traveled a lot for work then, and at the 500 Startups Conference, she met Bruno de Souza, a Brazilian app maker, and fell in love. According to people who were her friends at the time, she moved to Brazil and married him on a whim before the relationship quickly turned sour and she had to escape while de Souza was away on a trip. She bounced around, trying to figure out who she was. A professor she had worked with after college had witnessed Morgan's transformations by following her email signature alone. Back in college, Morgan had noted at the bottom of each email that she was an economist, before upgrading to economist and entrepreneur, once she arrived in San Francisco years later. As of late, the signature read, economist, entrepreneur, and hustler. Morgan once ran an email marketing company where, for a while, she became a minor celebrity in the cold email space. She then became a columnist for Forbes and Inc. magazines and labeled herself a fashion designer and surrealist artist. But nothing seemed to stick until she met Lichtenstein. Now the couple labeled themselves crypto investors. Under the guise of wanting to invest in these new startups, they began meeting with crypto companies to learn more about the tools they offered. We get a lot of incoming inquiries from people who want to invest in us, said the CEO of a crypto startup, who had agreed to meet with Morgan and Lichtenstein, but immediately noticed something off about their questions. We saw their backgrounds, and something looked strange. I found myself asking, who are these people? They had this Bonnie and Clyde vibe about them. Is she homeless? Is she broke? Could be either, could be both. All we know is Razzlecon is effing dope. The skies over New York City were gray on the morning of January 5th, 2022, when the feds returned to 75 Wall Street. This time was different. They didn't show up at 3 a.m., when the city and the residents of that towering brown building were fast asleep. They didn't approach the doorman with a ruse about child porn signals being sucked from the internet into a pervert's computer. Instead, on that frigid January morning, around 7 a.m., agents from the FBI, IRS Criminal Investigation Division, and Department of Homeland Security entered the rear of 75 with a search warrant. They boarded the freight elevator and rode up. A knock, an announcement, and inside an apartment they went. Into Dutch and Razzlecon's apartment. Over the past decade or so, digital investigators have learned how important it is to catch perpetrators off guard during a raid so they can't close their laptops or lock any of their electronics. Devices that, in this case, could offer important clues as to where the stolen crypto was stored. That morning, as the feds entered the apartment, chaos set in almost immediately. Clarissa, meow, scampered under the bed. When the couple was given an opportunity to stay and watch the feds rummage through their lives or leave, they opted to go, but first asked to get Clarissa. According to the criminal complaint, while Morgan climbed under the bed to fetch the kitty, she grabbed her cell phone from the nightstand and tried desperately to lock it. When an agent saw what she was doing, the agent had to wrestle the device from her. In all that day, agents retrieved $40,000 in cash, tied together with pink rubber bands, an assortment of foreign currencies in clear plastic bags, and another bag with the words burner phone written in black Sharpie. There were about 50 computer tablets, phones, and other electronics in the apartment. The feds also found a copy of the novel The Water Goats and another book on Japanese maps, which had both been hollowed out to hide money or electronics. The evidence taken from the raid allowed the feds to definitively tie the online wallet associated with the Bitfinex hack to Liechtenstein and Morgan, and a month later, they were arrested. The duo was charged with conspiracy to commit money laundering and conspiracy to defraud the United States, which are punishable by up to 25 years in prison. In its press release announcing the arrest, the government noted this was the largest financial seizure in U.S. history. While the government had managed to seize 94,000 Bitcoin worth around $3.6 billion, 25,000 of the original coins were missing and had been, according to the feds, transferred out of Liechtenstein's wallet via a complicated money laundering process that ended with some of the stolen funds being deposited into financial accounts controlled by Liechtenstein and Morgan. News of the arrest was like Clarissa's catnip for social media and the press. On Twitter, the couple was lambasted and ripped apart. "Never mind about the Bitcoin hack. This vid is a crime against humanity," one person wrote about Morgan's rap videos. "Judge got to add another 50 years to her sentence for this. I would like this better if she were silent," another person wrote about her videos. "It would not be humane to lock this person up with another human being," another wrote. Headlines leaned into the multiple nicknames the couple had given themselves over the years. "Meet the Crocodile of Wall Street rapper accused of laundering billions of dollars in crypto," wrote the Washington Post. Soon they got their own couple's nickname, Bitcoin Bonnie and Clyde, or Bitcoin Bonnie and Crypto Clyde. The case against them seemed to be so secure that they were already in talks to secure a plea deal. I asked one person involved in the investigation why the duo didn't just pull an Edward Snowden. "Hop on a plane to Russia or Ukraine, where they could eat blinis and drink vodka and launder their billions in stolen crypto." It turns out they were planning to do just that, going to Russia or Ukraine or both, and hiding out far from the reaches of the federal government, this person explained. That's why they had the passports and the cash and the books with the cutout holes to hide electronics. "It appears they were planning to leave, but that we got them right before they had the chance to do so." This person added, "There's a scenario where we would have entered their apartment with a search warrant, and they were already gone." Looking back, the oddest thing is what happened in the month between the time the feds raided the couple's home and the moment they were arrested and charged. While Liechtenstein remained relatively quiet online, as he had for the past several years, Morgan continued to post on all of her social media accounts as if nothing was going on, as if life were normal. She posted an early rap song she had written titled Bleeding Buckets, which was about getting her period. "Endometriosis, cleaving like mitosis," she sang, "feels so atrocious, lots of emotions, makes me ferocious." She proclaimed it was her effing theme song. Clarissa the cat continued to post pictures of her outings. and Morgan continued to tweet about crypto and investing. You wouldn't have believed that the woman behind these accounts was just days away from being arrested for conspiring to launder billions of dollars in Bitcoin. A woman who could possibly not get out of federal prison until she was 56 years old. Was Morgan just not that concerned about her fate? Or was her alter ego, Razulkan, as her friends had suspected, actually her way of dealing with a mounting pressure she simply didn't know how to escape? A clue into Morgan's psychological state came around the time the feds were closing in like a suffocating demon. One day, Morgan found herself on Facebook, and she came across a post by a friend who had had a rough go of it a few years earlier, and who, on this particular day, posted an image of a kintsugi pot, which, as Morgan knew all too well from her days in the Japanese club, is a piece of pottery that was broken, but had been pieced back together with glue and golden filigree. It is meant as a metaphor for embracing one's flaws and imperfections. Below the picture, Morgan commented that things were not going well for her. Life was not good, and like the pottery, she said, I feel broken. The friend saw the post and offered a little advice. Many of us feel broken. Hopefully, some of us get put back together again. There was a brief pause in the conversation, then Morgan responded with a half-smiley face emoji. A few days later, the news broke that she, along with Lichtenstein, had been arrested and charged with possessing $3.6 billion in stolen Bitcoin. The hundreds of friends that Morgan had made over the last 20 years couldn't have been more surprised by what they read. Of all the different alter egos and personalities that Morgan might have created, being a multi-billion-dollar crypto launderer was not among them. Shocked was all that people who knew Morgan and Lichtenstein could say when I asked what they thought when they read the news. Shocked. Lichtenstein, who was deemed a flight risk because of his Russian ties, is currently being held in a jail in Virginia. Morgan, who recently got her own lawyer, separate from the one she was sharing with her husband, was allowed to return to the apartment at 75 Wall Street. Both are currently negotiating a plea deal with the U.S. government. Neither of them have posted on social media since they were arrested. Razzle-dazzle, bitches. Vintage Audrey. After the Wing took a swan dive, its founder, Audrey Gelman, was in need of a reboot. With a Brooklyn shop hawking Hoot Thrift Treasures, the former political flack and power CEO is creating a new narrative by Emily Jane Fox. Opening photograph by Gillian Laub. Six Bells of the Ball, Audrey Gelman photographed in her newest venture, The Six Bells, in Brooklyn in June. In April, Audrey Gelman boarded a plane from JFK to Cleveland and drove about 75 miles to Berlin, Ohio, an Amish community of roughly 1,000 people, right near the self-proclaimed world's largest cuckoo clock, a 23-foot marvel from which every 30 minutes a five-piece robot Oompa band pops out to play Swiss polka music while a wooden couple dances. She checked into an Airbnb, ate a roast turkey and grilled country corn dinner at a communal table at Mrs. Yoder's kitchen, and a slice of the famous strawberry pie at Boyd and Worthman. She was only there for 36 hours to visit the Amish Country Pickers Antique Mall and the Walnut Creek Antique Mall to source wares for the home goods store she was about to open. She picked a hand-painted wooden cow, no fewer than 20 butter crocks, and an industrial pushcart that she stacked with pieces of spongeware, which she has always loved. She rented a Mercedes Sprinter van, for which, at 5 feet and an inch, she needed a booster seat to reach the steering wheel, and began the 10-hour haul back to Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, where the Six Bells would swing open its little forest green door later that month. She almost made it with just two bathroom breaks, listening to a book on tape about the Mitford sisters, but she had to call it at the edge of the city. Gelman, about a minute pregnant with her second child, stayed the night at the Hyatt next to the George Washington Bridge. This was about the 10th such trip Gelman had taken over the last nearly 2 years since she left the Wing, the all-female, WeWork-backed, pop-feminist, self-described coven of a co-working space that she co-founded in 2016. Gelman resigned in June 2020 as the pandemic set in, keeping all 12,000 of the company's members at home and their annual fees, up to $3,000 per person, suspended. The Wing shuttered the 11 locations it had opened over the course of 3.5 years, and as the Wall Street Journal reported, Gelman laid off all but 84 of its nearly 500 employees. A handful of Wing locations remain open, as do outposts of its imploded backer, WeWork. At the same time, against the backdrop of the protest that summer, former employees, most of them young women, drawn in by the company's mission of being a utopia for women on their way, alleged mistreatment they experienced, some of which they said was by Gelman herself. And they called for change. That meant Gelman. Next photos, bird's eye view. Gelman attends a Chanel dinner during the 2017 Tribeca Film Festival. Lauren Kassan and Gelman give Hillary Clinton a tour of the Wing Soho in 2018. I remember being pregnant with my son in 2019, taking a flight to Los Angeles, where I was for 3 hours before I flew back on a red eye that same night, and just thinking, I really wish that I just had a little store that sold things with like primitive cows on them, she told me, pointing toward a faded antique wooden cow perched on a red arrow that the website says will point you in the direction of the nearest cottage. The store wouldn't open for another hour or so, and morning light streamed through the gingham curtains. She lit Idyllic Morning, a vegan hemp soy-based candle made by Cottagecore Black Folks, one of the store's best-selling brands that smells of a fresh clothesline. Gelman wore white overalls and a plain white cotton tee. her unstraightened hair clipped half up to reveal her bare face behind thick black frames. This was not the Gelman whose last magazine interview featured her on the cover, bump cupping in a tight black power dress with a blowout and big promise as a master of the universe. Under the cover line, the women building America's most inspiring businesses. This was Gelman 2.0, minister of the Cobble Hill countryside. Obviously, yes, the life I am living now is really different than the life I was living, but it's a life that I fantasized about before. It's not a consolation prize, you know. The Wing, and life then, and the Six Bells, and life now, feel foundationally opposite and exactly the same. Aesthetically, the two spaces are diametric. If the Wing looked and felt like the most privileged, most online popular girl, then the Six Bells is her grandmother. The Wing's workplaces cropped up amid that pussy hat moment of the hyper-perfect Instagram grid when FOMO reigned and everyone sold perfection and order and access, the most curated lives you desperately wanted to exist in. Yet it was a cultural moment of disorder, chaos. The Wing is where the New York Times style section sent a reporter to watch what everyone assumed would be Hillary Clinton's victory in 2016, and ultimately where she found a soft place to land in her post-defeat press tour. The Wing was brazenly girly, though Gelman insisted otherwise to Architectural Digest, devoid of clutter, pitch perfect for the only New York era in recent memory that anointed the tryhards as cool. In Wing Sprach, it was intentional. Our inspiration was the apartment of a really cool Danish artist you wanted to make your best friend, Gelman told Architectural Digest as the first Wing location opened its doors. Vogue followed her as she and her partner scouted spots for their Paris location, calling the Wing a perfect, jealousy-inducing blend, the spatial, cool girl equivalent of a Letterman jacket. Walking into the Six Bells, on the other hand, feels like taking off your bra the instant you get home, tucked into a real-life block of nondescript brokerage firms and dry cleaners, is the charming fictional village of Barrows Green, which Gelman made up, and that is where the Six Bells, both real life and fictional, is doing business as a country store of homewares from a world far away, as the hand-painted sign out front says. A corporeal metaverse for the so-called grand millennials. Gelman has populated Barrows Green with a cast of characters to whom she gave backstories. Inside the store, she's hung oil portraits she's collected over the years to serve as avatars for the townspeople, with brass name plaques underneath to identify the likes of the town gossip, the businessman, the rabbi. The name of the store was inspired by a pub in Warborough, Oxfordshire, where several episodes of Gelman's favorite British crime serial, Midsummer Murders, were filmed. She made a pilgrimage last year. A watercolor map of the town that she commissioned hangs nearby. An interactive version lives on the website. The store is strewn with feather-stuffed frilled cushions, tiny cups and saucers, floral dinner plates designed in Paris, and hand-painted by artisans on the Amalfi Coast, mismatched paperbacks in primary colors that may disintegrate if you look at them too long. And enough block-printed linens. And precious quilting to fill a farmhouse. The Six Bells sells the work of more than 40 independent brands, along with antiques Gelman has selected on trips to Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, Verona, Virginia, and the like. You can practically hear your mother saying, "Look with your eyes, not your hands," and then go grab that old quilt. Next photos, Gelman and Glossier founder Emily Weiss at Refinery 29's 30 Under 30 celebration in 2013. Jennifer Lawrence speaking with Gelman in 2018. Ahead of its 2019 London expansion, The Wing hosts a dinner. "We have a motto that is written on a pillow in the store," says Letitia Gora of Rourke Design Studio, who designed the Six Bells with Gelman after doing spaces for The Wing for years. She came onto the project almost as soon as Gelman came up with the idea, "Out with the new and in with the old." So that's where we started. Gora settled on Farrow and Ball's cane, a cool yellow, wanting the walls to look like a memory of her grandfather's living room in Normandy. The rest of the store's colors, country red and forest green and mustard, were chosen to take people out of the whites and grays of the digital world. Gelma brought on Diva Pardue, a graphic designer who'd also worked with them at The Wing, to add what Pardue called a handmade feel to the branding, relying on book cloth and paper textures as backgrounds to make everything feel intentionally imperfect, not made on a computer. In a former life, teams would assemble 20,000 square foot spaces, sometimes at the same time. The Six Bells is 600 square feet, and counting Gelman, employs 5 people. "Every design is a reaction to what came before it," Gelman points out. "There is such sameness and such a sterile quality in design right now, and this is a very intentional departure from that. There's an alienation you start to feel when you look around and every coffee shop and dentist office looks identical, and it feels connected to the dystopia of the world." She herself felt alienated by all the minimalism, she said. "I just wanted to create something that was the furthest thing from an NFT possible. I've always been interested in the idea of opening a door, walking through it, and entering into a different reality. And right now, you enter into so many spaces that are missing any texture or personality. I wanted to create a space that both lowered people's blood pressures with a space and didn't take itself too seriously." What Gelman does, be it the Six Bells or the Wing or a political campaign or a TV show, has never mattered as much in drawing people's interest as the fact of Gelman doing it. She is an astute reader of rooms, a generationally gifted flack, a connector of people, willful enough in her control that before I had made a single call for this piece, I got a call from a mutual friend telling me that Gelman heard that I was writing a story about her. She is a storytelling capitalist and a builder of worlds who understands what her customers want before they know they want it. Don Draper, if he'd put himself in the ads. She is pretty and rich, unfailingly pulled together, and friends with everyone you hate watch on the internet. She is not a household name, but if the name Audrey Gelman does ring a bell, you have an opinion about her. She is highly conductive, radiating heat in the current era of guilty pleasure. "I can't explain it," she tells me, when I ask her why she thinks people have such a strong reaction to her. "I guess I am just not for everyone." People started tripping over Gelman nearly a decade ago when, at 26, she managed to wrangle all the downtown kids and New York celebrities to care about a snooze of a candidate in a snooze of a race for the New York City comptroller. No one had much heard of the candidate, Scott Stringer, yet all the great rags from Page Six to New York Magazine to Women's Wear Daily turned up to write about a fundraiser he held at the Maritime Hotel in Chelsea. Not since Bloomberg banned smoking almost everywhere in town has City Hall politics garnered so much interest among the downtown fashion set, Vogue wrote of the evening. New York called it the most hip fundraiser in the history of the office of New York City Comptroller. But nobody was there for the candidate. People turned up because of Gelman. She was a thing, Lena Dunham's best friend, who worked on Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign, dated Terry Richardson, and followed the Stringer gig with a stint as senior vice president at the PR firm SKD Knickerbocker. Let's Go Mets was tattooed on her inner lip. She listened to speed metal, wore Chanel and Jimmy Choo, and played a recurring role in Dunham's hit HBO show Girls, a wink of a cameo, as she plays opposite the character Marnie, who is said to be based on Gelman. After Stringer's win, before she left politics and PR to start what would eventually turn into The Wing, the New York Times called her a bold-faced name in her own right, dogged in her pursuits, dubbing her the girl most likely. She was everywhere, toggling between meetings and parties, D.C. and New York, a top contender in the busy Olympics. She got tired of changing for events in Starbucks bathrooms, so she came up with the idea for Refresh Club, a practical place where women could access well-appointed locker rooms, maybe redo their hair, and meet up with friends between work and play. She brought on a co-founder, Lauren Kassan, who expanded the concept to make it more of an all-encompassing co-working space for women. The women went out to raise money alongside other millennial female-founded startups like Glossier, Away, and Outdoor Voices. All of them faced the headwinds of seeking funds from primarily male VCs and investors. That is to say, women receive less than 3% of all venture money invested in startups, closer to 2% in the last year. Amid the twin phenomenons of Donald Trump and the hashtag MeToo movement, Gelman, like many women executives at the time, leaned in, reference intended, to a mission beyond the fundamentals. The co-founders renamed the idea The Wing to hearken back to Virginia Woolf's notion that women need an entire wing to themselves. And the company began racking up millions of dollars from the likes of Adam Newman at WeWork and Whitney Wolf Heard of Bumble, Valerie Jarrett, Mindy Kaling, and Megan Rapinoe. Their beauty rooms were wrapped in a custom toile wallpaper of women hopping from taxis to race to yoga and school pickup. Conference rooms and phone booths were named after Lisa Simpson and Ramona Quimby and Christine Blasey Ford. The Perch, its cafe, sold wine from female vintners and a Fork the Patriarchy bowl. They hired women architects, hung women artists, booked women speakers, from Serena Williams to Lorena Gallo, formerly Bobbitt. Keychains declaring girls doing whatever the F they want could be had for $15. Next photos, girl interrupted. Then, the press secretary to the Manhattan Borough president, Gelman hosts a 2012 debate party with Downtown for Democracy, D4D, and Vice. Gelman mingling with Terry Richardson and Jared Leto at a 2011 Barney's New York party. The world that Gelman built with The Wing, as we know, ended up eating her. Her knack for the narrative has been both her hook and her heel. People believed in what she was selling at The Wing so much that when the inherent tensions between capitalism and feminism pulled at its seams, too much had been stuffed inside of it by her, by the media writing piece after piece about her and other so-called girl bosses of the time, that it could not contain itself. The resulting explosion was both general to the time and specific to The Wing. Gelman, like her contemporaries, was in the thrall of a toxic loop. In order to raise money, they needed to stand for something, be public-facing, and hit incomprehensible growth targets. But being public-facing and responsible for a mission greater than just creating extreme growth subjected them to intense scrutiny and to the higher standards they themselves had set. At times, it seemed like The Wing was a piñata with Gelman's face on it, in part because she sold herself as a leader who could cure cultural ills. In practice, tensions had been mounting since well before the pandemic. After the New York City Commission on Human Rights investigated the club in 2018 for gender discrimination, it began allowing members of all genders. The investigation concluded the following year when both parties reached an agreement. This was followed by an incident at the West Hollywood location. When a white guest allegedly yelled at a black member over a parking space, in the fall of 2019, the company hosted a series of community meetings about race around the time Gelman posed for Inc. magazine's female founder issue, making her the first visibly pregnant CEO on the cover of a magazine. Next photos, Gelman and her husband, Elon Zekory, outside Baltazar in 2018, a millennial cool kid roundtable of Matt Colon, Steve Aoki, Gelman, and Lena Dunham at a 2007 T-Mobile event in Park City, Utah. Gelman in 2012. The October 2019 cover of Inc. In February 2020, she wrote a short piece in Fast Company admitting that she had erred in selling a new version of a decades-old fantasy that didn't account for the reality that running a company is messy, terrifying, and often chaotic. When your product is community and the emotional and professional ecosystem that people create together, your work is inherently challenging, she went on, especially without the consistent self-interrogation of our own blind spots as white cis women. This has led to serious stumbles and outright failures. The hardest part, she added, was that these failures led us to inadvertently replicate some of the very social hierarchies we'd set out to dismantle. Soon after, a New York Times magazine story raised questions about the company's and Gelman's treatment of staff, particularly women of color, who worked in hourly roles at the wing. And then the COVID lockdown took hold. When the wing posted on Instagram that it would donate $200,000 to racial justice organizations in the wake of George Floyd's murder in June 2020, former employees continued to speak out about what their experiences had been like working with the wing, from low-wage positions to unfair treatment, an experience that seemed antithetical to the public ideologies that Gelman and the company spent years building up. Gelman resigned as CEO on June 11, 2020, the week after her 33rd birthday, and issued a public apology. In the months around Gelman's cancellation and resignation, a handful of other white women founders, including Steph Corey of Away, Leandra Medine of Man Repeller, Christine Barbarich of Refinery 29, and Yale Aflalo of Reformation, all stepped down amid similar accusations of racism and toxic workplaces. It's clear that there was a gap between the values we expressed publicly at the wing and the day-to-day experiences our employees had working at the company, Gelman told me recently. Many of those complaints were centered around race, and I deeply regret the experiences these employees had at the wing and that they weren't addressed appropriately. As the CEO at the time, the buck stopped with me, and I take full accountability. She has taken the time to speak to former employees in what she called private and meaningful conversations. She maintains she is proud of the richness and specialness of the wing, the friendships and relationships. It's correct and important for people who are running companies and made the decision to take on that responsibility, knowing that it comes with the territory, to take responsibility for the mistakes that you've made and ways you've fallen short. And being a woman is not a shield or a way to shield from accountability around mistakes that were made. At the same time, she explains, it felt like there was an idolatry that was part of the female founder mythology. She was expected to be both the engine and the hood ornament, someone once told her. In terms of investors, employees, the media, there are mismatched expectations, and yes, different standards. And there are a lot of young women who are afraid to start companies because they think that is the price of admission. When Gelman resigned, she told the Times that she was looking forward to spending time as a stay-at-home mom, which she did and she loved. She and her husband, Elon Zekery, who sold his company Genius for $80 million last year, tucked into their home upstate. She is uncomfortable when, over the course of reporting this story, I ask her about the period of time between when she had left the wing and started working on the Six Bells. I told her that I'd heard she sold her $3.3 million house in Brooklyn last year. This is true. I had also heard that she worked as a waitress part-time for 3 months at a diner not far from their home. Also true. I wanted something to do, and I knew the women there, and they were like, come on in. Her husband went back to school to become a practicing psychoanalyst. She was alienated and at home for the first time, along with everyone else. The hustle culture sterility gave way to a slow era of cozy pandemic maximalism, one in which those grand millennials wore nap dresses on Zoom calls in homes outside of cities that they absconded to for months on end. She would read her son a book, It's Okay, Slow Lizard, about how all these animals are so anxious and going as fast as they can and doing a million things. And then there is this little lizard there reminding them that there is a different way to live. I became very into that philosophically. So Gelman built a world around that feeling, albeit one in which everything was for sale. The Six Bells was the productive application of hundreds of hours of reading through stacks of G.K. Chesterton and Anthony Horowitz and watching all the British crime shows there ever were. Gelman and Perdue hired an Irish illustrator named Niamh Langton to draw a map of the town that would be interactive, where people could scroll over the different locations and click on characters. She says she didn't know this at the time, but Walt Disney's first illustration of Disney World looks very similar to the Six Bells interactive map. She showed me a photo of a brass plaque hung where you walk into Disneyland that reads, "Here you leave today and enter the world of yesterday, tomorrow, and fantasy." So, yes, it's a commercial enterprise, but in some ways, says Gelman, that is secondary, because you are so absorbed by the storytelling. There is a snapback to reality from running a company on the unicorn track, managing tens of thousands of square feet of real estate and hundreds of employees, to stocking antiques and baskets in an eensy neighborhood storefront. But the smallness so far suits her. There is a grinding pressure that comes along with growth and scale, and it can end up degrading things that begin small and special, and I did want to resist that here. There are the things that you think are going to make you happy, she said, and the things that actually make you happy. So far, customers seem happy to be in her world again, even if they don't want to admit it. In a piece for The Cut, writer Danielle Cohen wrote that she rolled my eyes so hard my eyeballs just about left my skull when she heard about the concept. Drawn in by the prospect of hate browsing this problematic fairy tale / brand concept, she continued, I soon came to the realization that actually I would very much like to buy some of this stuff, and frankly, I'm ready to move in. The Cut posted the story to its Instagram, referring to Gelman as disgraced founder, prompting scores of comments about how harsh the tone of the post was. The word disgraced has since been removed from the post without a note. The antique sold out so fast the first week that she had to make an emergency trip to Virginia to restock. So, too, did the little soaps made to look like purple grapes, made by a family that's been crafting soap in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli since 1803. Online shoppers are spending more than their in-store counterparts, and they have hailed from faraway lands. Plano, Texas, Birmingham, Alabama, Perkiomenville, Pennsylvania, Winooski, Vermont, and Bremen, Maine. just as the Six Bells aesthetic of quarantined ladies needle-pointing in their gardens supplanted the aspirational perfectionism of the wing, so too taste will shift again. I actually think the aesthetic of the Six Bells is rooted in changelessness, Gelman told me, which is why it supersedes trend. In June, she hosted the Six Bells' first summer fete at Inga's Bar in Brooklyn Heights, where editors and writers from Architectural Digest, The Wall Street Journal, and Vogue, brand founders, and friends of Gelman's, drank orange ginger spritzes and solved a semi-immersive mystery hosted by the Barrow's green town gossip, Ursula Lumley. Another gathering is planned for the fall. She isn't thinking about opening a second location yet, though she's not dreaming of what's next. The Vermont Country Store, a company she has loved since she was a child, comes to mind. According to the map, Barrow's Green has a fictional inn, which begs the question of whether Gelman could open a real one. I think the way to evolve and grow a brand like this is through new forms, and not necessarily through changing the product to shift to whatever the new taste emerge, she says. I'm approaching this with a different mentality. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.